Good afternoon, it's 3 o'clock and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on Monday the 16th of April of the year 2012. Jeff Brown with you here on a Juneau afternoon. Today we'll find out about this Thursday's fly fishing workshop with guest John Lyman. We'll also hear the writer's almanac, bird note, music and more today on a Juneau afternoon. Also be talking to Kristen Bomagin about a workshop this weekend on international humanitarian law brought to you by the Red Cross. The forecast for tonight, increasing clouds in the evening, then rain likely. Later on, low temperatures around 39 degrees. Forecast for Tuesday looks like cloudy skies with a chance of rain and high temperatures around 51 degrees. Tuesday night, mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of rain, and Wednesday, mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of rain.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. In Canada, there was a big step towards reconciliation for Indian residential school survivors in Manitoba. First Nations elders adopted a Catholic archbishop during a ceremony in Winnipeg. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
The Catholic Church was one of four churches that ran the government-funded residential school system across Canada. More than 150,000 First Nations children were forced to attend the schools as part of a plan to assimilate them into white culture. But thousands were physically, sexually, or emotionally abused. On the weekend, Roman Catholic Archbishop James Weisgerber was adopted by a group of First Nations residential school survivors. One of the elders at the ceremony was the former National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations, Phil Fontaine.
He's accepted the invitation to be part of our family, be part of our community, to be, in fact, a real brother in this large, very large extended family.
Weisgerber says it shows that the First Nations community is open to reconciliation.
In so many ways, our presence here has damaged the Aboriginal people, their culture, their language, their communities, and they are the ones who are asking us for reconciliation. This is a huge kind of symbolic gesture.
Weisgerber says still more work lies ahead in the efforts to heal the rifts. He talked about the generosity of Aboriginal people, and he called on all people in Manitoba to make the commitment to reconciliation. It was Weisgerber who asked Pope Benedict 3 years ago to meet with residential school survivors. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The Blackfeet Nation honors one of its soldiers who died in Afghanistan. On Sunday, the tribe held a ceremony as the body of Antonio Burnside returned home to Browning, Montana. The 31-year-old Army specialist died April 6th from enemy fire in an engagement with insurgents. The tribe says he was active in Blackfeet life. He was a traditional dancer and grass dancer, as well as a participant in tribal ceremonies. Burnside sang with the Grey Horse Singers and studied the Cree language. He survived by his parents, his wife, four children, and two siblings. The soldier is the second Blackfeet member to be killed in Afghanistan. Master Sergeant William Carlson was killed in 2003. A founder of Dene College has passed away. 77-year-old Ruth Russell died Friday in Cortez, Colorado, after a brief illness. She was an advocate and champion of education and Navajo teachings. Russell and her husband helped found the Rough Rock Demonstration School in the 1960s, which was the first Native American-controlled community school in the country. They also helped found the Navajo Community College, now Dene College. She had a long teaching career at schools across the reservation and was the author of 5 books on Navajo history, culture, and education. Russell survived by 5 children and was buried on Sunday. An Alaska Native organization receives one of the nation's highest presidential awards for business innovation and performance. South Central Foundation says it's the first Native organization to receive the Malcolm Baldrige National Quality Award. South Central was one of 4 award recipients honored Sunday in Washington, D.C. The Alaska Native-owned and operated healthcare organization provides care to about 60,000 Alaska Natives and American Indians in the Anchorage Area Service Unit. On this day in 1946, musician R. Carlos Nakai was born in Flagstaff, Arizona. The Navajo and Ute man has been nominated for 4 Grammy Awards. His flute albums, Canyon Trilogy and Earth Spirit, have been certified gold by the Recording Industry Association of America. Nakai was inducted into the Arizona Music and Entertainment Hall of Fame in 2005. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
With funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Humboldt State University, part of the California State University System, offering a part-time, 3.5-year online Master of Social Work program, emphasizing work in rural and indigenous communities. A new semester begins January of 2013. Applications will be accepted in August. Learn more at humboldt.edu/social work.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:06. You are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our first guest is John Lyman, who's not a big fan of the sunshine. John, thank you for coming down to the station today.
Oh, thanks. I just wish it were raining.
Although there's always that side of the life here in Southeast Alaska. You're with Tarted Lemonade, and you're here to talk about Pathways to Fly Fishing, a workshop going on this Thursday from April 19th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Clinton and Haida Center. First, tell me about Tarted Lemonade.
Well, Trout Unlimited is a national organization, a lot like Ducks Unlimited. Some of your folks might be familiar with them. TU has been accused of being all fly fishing, but it's not. Their motto is, what's good for the fish is good for the fishermen. And we're real concerned right now about northern southeast and some of the fisheries issues going on here. And I think we all need to be concerned a little bit about this drought that we're in, because we need that rain. We need it in our creeks. We need it in our rivers. We need it on the land.
Bennett, what kind of activities have you been up to lately?
Oh, I don't know. I've been skiing a lot. You know, I've been tying some flies, working on a couple rods, a few old bamboo rods, and then working on this project. We've been out in Angoon with 4-H. They're getting a big program on fishing and hunting started there for the kids. But this one in particular is for the newcomer adult. Now, we don't mind you bring your kids. You're welcome to bring your kids, but please don't just drop your kids off as a babysitting service. This is so that people who have never had any idea how to fly fish, that are interested, that actually want to learn, can get introduced not only to the sport, but also to the opportunities for partnerships with everything from the businesses in town to the clubs. We've got Rain Country Fly Fishers, very active group that teaches fly tying and fishing. We've got the 4-H Outdoor Skills Program, which runs all winter long. It's going to be shutting down here in another couple of weeks, but 4-H and Alaska Department of Fish and Game co-sponsor a fishing club all summer, some folks might not be aware of. And we do fly fishing than that, as well as spin fishing. Every Thursday evening, families go together to different fishing venues. All the tackle's provided. You have experts there to show you how. We've handled several hundred people in that in the last few years it's been going.
What is fly fishing? Is it actually designed to simulate the action of a fly?
Well, fly fishing is kind of a catch-all phrase. It started 2,000 years ago with Macedonians imitating an insect and trying to catch these spotted fishes, trout in Macedonia, north of Greece. First time we know about that. But it became a big deal about 500 years ago in England, when the elite chose this method of fishing in order to go after what was then food stocks, which were denied to the average common man because of the need for labor after the plague. It was illegal in England for a commoner to even own a net or a hook. So you were fishing, you were an elitist person. Well, fly fishing came out of that. But the first book we know about it is actually from the 12th century. It was written in Germany, in a little enclave in Germany. And for a long time, they thought it was some kind of cryptic religious thing, because it came out of a monk's cell. And then he finally showed this list of items to someone who happened to be a fly fisher, and he said, well, those are just the the materials you use for tying flies. And so from the 12th century, we have a list of commoners' materials that farmers would find, from pig's fur to chicken feathers, that were being used to take fish in Europe. Fly fishing has a very long history. If you want to go back as far as I can see it, I went out to St. Lawrence Island and taught fly tying to some of the native folks out there several years ago. And halfway through tying a Clouser minnow, one of the elders who had just had a stroke turned to me. I was helping him hold the thread while he positioned the material. And he said, "You know, we do this all the time." And I said, no, I've only been here for a couple of days." And he said, no, we tie feathers on hooks to catch fish." And you could have bowled me over. And he went on to tell me about four different patterns, if you will, methods of using feathers to catch fish that they have used in that village from time immemorial. So it's not like it's a new thing or something that's really elitist. It's something that everyone has done, using your local resources to take fish. Now fly fishing the way it is done today, with all the fancy rods and the reels and all, can be extremely elitist. You can go to lodges that cost $1,000 a day. But also remember, it's a commoner's activity. It's a fun thing. And so we focus on that fun thing. We get kids and families started, several families in town now say that because of participation in our programs with 4-H and Trout Unlimited, this is their family activity all summer long, that they go fly fishing together. We have incredible amounts of opportunities. The dollies are coming back to the shoreline now, all the way from Fish Creek, all the way down through the channel. When we get a good plankton bloom, which is really dependent largely upon the rain, they're going to release the fry from the hatchery, and as those fry wash in and out and move up and down the channel, the dollies are going to be following those animals, and we'll teach you patterns, many patterns. Brad's got them in the shop. You can go down and have a great time catching dollies and sea-run cutthroats following that school of fish down.
What's the secret for tying a believable fly if they do a fool of fish?
Oddly enough, the first ones you tie are probably going to be the best, because after that you're going to get serious about it, and you're going to want it to look like the thing in the book. But remember, fish are opportunistic. And so if they see something that's got a resemblance to something they eat, but it's wrong, it's probably wounded, so it's going to be easy prey. You're tying these lovely mayflies that, you know, drift across the top of the water. Well, you tie one where you really louse it up and it looks like a cripple, well, that's going to be the easiest thing for them to chase down. It's not going to fly away from them. And so oftentimes the people that you would think would have the best luck, well, it's that beginner that oftentimes has better luck.
How long does a typical fly last for you?
It depends on how many bushes I snag behind me. you never count on one fly. You know, I mean, guys will have rafts and have open up a box and it'll be nothing but blue wing olives, you know, hundreds of them. Now, I don't know if they got into it and they were just doing it one night drinking too much beer, or they're going to use all those flies, but I'll guarantee some of them going to hung up in the bushes. And that's going to get into one of the things we'll do on the 17th, or on the 19th, between 7 and 9, is we're going to teach a couple of real simple casts that will work, and one of them, the roll cast, will keep your fly out of the bushes, and it's really all you need here in Southeast.
What's the magic in fly fishing for you?
Well, the magic is that there's so much to it. A, it's the history. I love history. I collect books. I have books from the 16th century on fly fishing. It was once said that more has been written about fly fishing than any other subject. And so you can get into incredible libraries. I build bamboo rods, and so I'm dealing with planing bamboo to a thousandth of an inch tolerances to glue it up and go catch fish. I tie my own flies. There's a passionate group of guys. But much more than that, in order to be successful with fly fishing, it's not like bait. Bait, you're putting something out there the fish is likely to eat because it's the same as what it's trying to eat, herring or sand lance or whatever. But with fly fishing, you're taking foreign materials, and you've got to understand the environment well enough that, A, you know what's going to be in the environment, and B, you know how it's going to react and why the fish, what behavior of that fly you can imitate from 50 feet away that will make that fish set aside his reservations and go after that fly.
How long does it take you to tie a fly?
Well, it depends. The other night, I was tying over an Angoon, and somebody asked the same question, and we managed to tie a lake leech in 32 seconds. So that was pretty good. And that fish, that fly will catch fish. That's one of the flies that we'll teach here. If you've ever been up to, like, the cabins up at Windfall Lake, and you go across the lake, and your loved one's in the canoe with you, and you're paddling away, and they pick their hand up out of the water, they're likely to have a leech on their hand. Lakes are filled, these shallow water lakes here are filled with these leeches, and there's no bones in them, they're pure protein. The fish that are in there love them. So we tie a fly that, if you handle it correctly, will look like a lake leech swimming, and it can be an excellent, excellent fly. And it's one feather, takes a minute.
You mentioned handling it correctly. Is there an art in that?
Yeah, there absolutely is. If you're fishing the surface, you want a dead drift. You want that fly, the material, the leader, to be just drifting as if there's no tension on it. If you're fishing subsurface, then you're trying to get that fly to imitate whatever it is that it's supposed to be. If it's supposed to be a wounded bait fish, then you want it to dart up and down. Okay, and there's a way of tying flies that will do that. If you're in the salt water and you're fishing for kings, well, coho like to have things kind of presented in an odd manner, so you might jerk it and strip the line to get the fly to dart about. But a king salmon likes to chase things down in a steady line, so you're casting as far as you can, tucking the rod up under your arm and stripping one hand right after the other, pulling the thing back in at you, trying to keep it at the fish's level. That's a lot of the charm, is that you have to understand what's happening in nature and then try and imitate it using synthetic or natural materials. Federation of Fly Fishers, I was their education VP for about 10 years, and their motto is that the least important thing about fly fishing is catching fish. And they really mean it. So,
talking to John Lyman, who does enjoy catching fish, but he's going to be leading a workshop on pathways to fly fishing this Thursday, April 19th, from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Clinkett and Haida Center. Is it classes for adults?
Oh, well, we're targeting adults this time. Last time we did a pathways event with Fish and Game, everybody dropped off their kids. And then when the kids went home, Dad showed up the next night, or Mom showed up the next night, saying, I don't know which end of this thing to hold, but my kid wants to go fishing, so you got to teach me. So we figure it's just a lot easier if we start with the parents who are going to want to teach their kids. And Pathways, this one, is for the adult or the person, the family, that wants to get into the sport but really doesn't know. And I'll make a pitch for volunteers now. If you know how to fly fish, then come on in and give us a hand, because oftentimes we'll have far more people than we can handle at these events. And you don't have to be an expert. We're going to have the 4-H kids tying lake leeches. Pretty simple. Those kids can show you how to be successful with it. Rain Country is going to come in and do the pickup and lay down cast and the roll cast. All of their members aren't experts. They're learning. We're all still learning. And so there's an opportunity there to serve and to join these clubs as well. Even if you know the basics, well, you can help with others as well. This is that whole mentoring thing that's really important in fly fishing.
How much does it cost?
Nothing. Brad Elfers, Fly Fishing Goods, going to donate all the materials to us. Fishing Game's going to let us use their rods and vices for tying. We've got volunteers coming in to do this whole thing. So people just show up. Doors will be open for the public between 7 and 9 on Thursday at Clinkett and Hyder Center on Hospital Drive. and come on in, see what's there, get familiar with people, maybe join a club, and just take the basics with you on what's involved in this sport.
So they really don't have to bring anything except themselves?
Nothing but yourself. Bring a little water to drink.
You sure like fishing, don't you?
Yeah, I love to fish.
Why?
Well, first I fill my, and you know, I'm not a catch and release nut. I believe in catch and release with some species. Like, I don't kill steelhead, and I'm careful with trout, and might kick one a year or something to eat. But I fill my freezers with salmon and halibut, just like everybody else. I'm down to my last box of fish. It's time for me to start killing kings.
Do you have a website for Trout Unlimited?
Yeah, there is. The local site we brought down because it was kind of archaic. But there is, if you just go TU, Trout Unlimited, there's a national site. And there's several issues that pertain to Alaska right now. Probably, of course, the biggest one everybody knows about is Pebble Mine. We've been real active in that. We're very concerned, along with the native peoples out there, about the fisheries and what Pebble will mean. There's also a push now in cooperation with the commercial and sport fisheries folks here in town to try and set aside 70 healthy systems, watersheds, that have not been logged and not been heavily impacted to guarantee the continuation of natural runs in southeast Alaska. Now, these are ones that are LUD 1 classifications. Now, we'd like to see them in LUD 2.
What does LUD stand for?
Well, it's this land use designation from the Forest Service. And the first one, they can still be entered and they can be logged. The second one, well, there's a little bit stronger classification to keep them out of commercial development because the natural resources are so important. When we look at the economic development, not just for Juneau, but for everywhere in southeast Alaska, our fisheries still lead. Whether it's commercial or sport or subsistence, it's still the lifeblood of this place. And we need to make certain that those wild places continue.
John Lyman, thank you for going down to the station and talking about Pathways to Fly Fishing this Thursday, April 19th from 7 to 9 p.m. Is there a phone number people can contact you with?
Yeah, you can call me. I'll give you my email. It's jonlymanak at gmail.com. And my phone number is 907-723-3997.
Glad you could remember it today.
Yeah, it's hard to remember things. Sometimes you get this old, it's just a
just keep fishing and remember how to do that.
Yeah, as long as I keep fishing, I think I'll be okay.
Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
No, just want it to rain, baby. Give me some more water on the creek.
Packing up the truck, heading down the road. We're on a mission, we're going fishing. Pick a cool spot, unload our gear, set up our poles and fish right here. Make the first cast, then make a wish. I bet I'll catch the very first fish. I'm so happy, I'm going fishing. No matter where we go, where the waters flow, we're on a mission, we're going fishing. Go to Homer, drive all the way down, or fish at Ship Creek, right downtown. Get the line wet, it's fun, you bet. I could catch the biggest fish yet. I've been wishing I could go fishing. I'm so happy I'm going fishing. And reds, halibut and chums, dollies and rainbows, yum, yum, yum. Clean up the fish, take the meat from the bone, fire up the barbecue and eat them up at home. Fire up the barbecue and eat them up at home.
Time is 3:25. You are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guest is Christian Bomagen here to talk about Red Cross course and international humanitarian law going on this weekend. Christian, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity to come and talk to your listeners about this exciting class that the Red Cross is offering.
Can you describe it, please?
Oh, yes. It's called International Humanitarian Law and subtitled Humanity in the Midst of War. It'll be offered Saturday at the Mendenhall Valley Public Library Conference Room from 10 to 3 that day, though depending on the weather, we may try to abbreviate our breaks a little bit. It's generally about a four-hour course, but we do want to provide for lunch. The subject matter of the course itself is the American Red Cross's activities to meet its humanitarian mission around the world as part of the global Red Cross network. And so we're going to talk about the body of humanitarian law, which is primarily comprised of the Geneva Conventions and the subsequent protocols that were adopted since then. And it's how the International Committee of the Red Cross and the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies work together to work towards providing protection and humanitarian protection in the midst of armed conflict throughout the world.
Could you describe briefly the Geneva Conventions?
Well, there are four Geneva Conventions, and they were the conventions of August 12, 1949, and they address rules common to armed conflict. The first convention protects, it's for the amelioration and condition of the wounded and sick in armed conflicts in the field. And the second convention protects protects combatants who are wounded, sick, or shipwrecked at sea. So the first two conventions address both land and naval battles, and humanitarian principles should be applied when people who are engaged in combat are removed from combat, either through sickness because they're wounded and can no longer fight, or they're taken as prisoners of war. And so it sets up principles, humane principles, for their treatment when they are no longer engaged in a battle or an armed conflict. The third convention addresses the treatment of prisoners of war, and the fourth convention addresses the treatment of civilians in the context of armed conflict.
How did they come about in the first place?
Well, the history of the development of international humanitarian law really goes to the founder of the International Red Cross, Henri Dunant, who was a Swiss businessman who, when in his travels to establish business enterprises, was a witness to the Battle of Solferino, at which there were thousands of wounded and wounded soldiers who were left in the field with no one to care for them after the battle ended. And it touched him. He engaged the local community to come out and administer to the needs of these wounded soldiers. And was appalled there was no provision for doing that before at wartime. And so he wanted to promote this. He left that circumstance, wrote a book about it, and tried to promote the development of a prepared group of people who would be able to go in and administer to those who were no longer engaged in the battle in armed conflict. And so it started out with a group of a number of businessmen and people who had humanitarian interests at the time, and developed from there. There were about 19 countries, I think, that were involved as it first started, and that grew until now, with the formal adoption of the Geneva Conventions in 1949 and beyond. Now, virtually every country in the world is a signatory to these conventions. And almost every country has their own either Red Crescent or Red Cross Society that has taken on the preparations to be able to administer to those who need assistance in those circumstances, and to address humanitarian needs in the cases of disaster and some of the other things that we're more familiar with generally.
How does the Red Cross differ from the Red Crescent?
The Red Cross and Red Crescent, well, the Red Cross was the initial emblem that was used by all of the societies as it first developed. And that emblem was chosen because, it was a Swiss organization. The Swiss flag was impartial in times of war, and they have the red Swiss flag is a white cross on a red field, and they adopted the reverse out of respect for Henri Dunant, the founder, and the rest of the, to have the red cross on a white field. But after time, people came to believe that it was a Christian symbol of some sort, that in the context of religious conflicts. People were not as enthusiastic about the cross and wanted to use a symbol of another religion, of the Muslim religion, the crescent. And so through negotiations, they determined that they would expand the symbol so that those countries which preferred the red crescent would use that. The symbol has never been a religious identifier, but because so much conflict has come up in those contexts, this is how they've chosen to address the protective symbol, depending on what part of the world people live in. So there's not really any difference in the societies and their missions themselves. It's only the countries that choose to adopt either symbol.
Talking with Kristen Bomagin, who's going to be teaching a Red Cross course in international humanitarian law. And it's happening this Saturday. We'll get to
this Saturday from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., and it will be at the Mendenhall Valley Public Library Conference Room. We're hoping that people will sign up in advance. You can call the Red Cross office. It's 463-5713, or email rita.george2@redcross.org. And if you don't have a pencil at the moment in the car, you can find us on the community calendar or simply call the Red Cross office. And that way we'll know how much information to have available. We want copies of the materials for everyone.
What are some of the common values in humanity in the midst of war?
I talked a little bit about the fundamental principles of the International Red Cross and the movement itself. I've been a volunteer with Red Cross for a number of years, but I came to it through the way that many of us come to it, through becoming familiar with the local disaster preparedness or the first aid classes, swimming classes, any number of things that people usually become involved with the Red Cross through, and not really knowing some of the background, and it really inspired me and excited me when I learned more about the fundamental principles that guide all of the actions of the Red Cross and Red Crescent societies throughout the world. They have seven guiding principles: humanity, impartiality, neutrality, independence, voluntary service, unity, and universality. And if I may, I'll just talk a little bit about those principles.
Please do.
Humanity, of course, is the first principle, striving to prevent and alleviate suffering, protecting life and health, and ensuring respect for the human being and human dignity. And you can see that in much of the work that the Red Cross does, not only in this context of international humanitarian efforts, but also in its in the way it steps up in natural disasters where people are suffering and have basic needs that aren't being met, and the Red Cross and the Red Crescent Society in that country will step in to provide for people's needs. Impartiality is the principle that there's no discrimination as to nationality, race, religion, class, political opinion. The administering to the combatants is the principle is that without any regard for which side they were fighting on, it's to meet the basic human dignity of the person and the needs that they have to be respected as human beings. So we're impartial in the way that services are offered. Neutrality, we're neutral. Again, do not take any sides in political hostilities or in religious or ideological controversies. Independence, the organizations are independent of their governments and function without any dependence upon those governments, maintain autonomy from the governments that they within the country in which they serve. Voluntary service is to maintain that the activities of the Red Cross are not prompted by a desire for financial gain. And so the principle of providing volunteer service is maintained and respected.
Mm-hmm.
And just briefly, the last two, unity. There's only one Red Cross or Red Crescent Society in any one country, and that one society is open to everyone who wishes to participate. So there's no discrimination within a country about who can participate in the Red Cross or Red Crescent Society. And universality, that the movement is worldwide. And that is one of the, again, as I mentioned before, the Geneva Conventions are known as the most signed on treaty that exists in the world today.
I want to take a side trip for a little bit. I've always been impressed with the work that you've done as far as election supervising in various countries. You have a moment to share some of your experiences in that regard?
I'd be happy to. And in large part, I mean, my involvement in elections supervising started following the Bosnia Wars. And that's where I'd say I developed some of my interest in the body of international humanitarian law and how civilians in particular are treated in the context of armed conflict. As an aside, it's estimated that probably about 90% of the victims of armed conflict today are civilians. They're not combatants and they're not the military themselves, but the civilian population. When I went to Bosnia, the work we did there was at the when they were beginning to get elections developed in the country after the war, and we participated with we were each given an interpreter, a person who drove us around, who was familiar with the countryside that we were working in, and we worked with an election team in that community. And so we would spend a week to 2 weeks with people who had lived through the war and had their stories to tell. And so often we would have an opportunity to engage them and their families in the stories about what they had lived through, what divided them within their own communities, the suffering that they went through. And so it became very personal, because we were able to know the people that were there. Too often, I was concerned with the area first by just seeing it on TV, hearing about it on the radio, and reading what I could to find out what was behind that war in particular. But then when I was able to meet people and learn more about people on both sides of the conflict, about how it affected their families, their lives, it just was all the more significant. And I know that I come away from each of those opportunities that I have to meet people who have endured those circumstances and are in moving forward with a hope for their own society and their children and their families, that I come away from that all the more, wanting all the more for people to understand how we can alleviate suffering like that, how we can, through our own actions and consciousness, reach out to comfort and reach out to try to make things better.
Any standout experiences among dozens, I guess?
Well, there's, in particular, I was, one of my trips, I worked with the resettled population from Srebrenica. They had resettled in Tuzla. And there, the head of the polling station that I worked at, he had spent a week trying to evade the military that was really killing all of the young men, military-aged men, at that time. I met one of his staff was a gentleman who had not seen his son since he was bussed away from Srebrenica, and his hope was he still held on to a hope that his son was somewhere in Europe, that he had made it out, and just was too fearful to come back to identify himself back in the country at that time. And the loss was so profound. I think that, you know, I come away from those experiences just hoping that there is something that we can do by raising our own awareness and consciousness and conveying our opinions within our own country and abroad to assure that people will respect the dignity of all the human beings that are involved in those conflicts.
Did it affect your, how much did it affect your stance on various issues here in the United States?
Well, I teach this course without necessarily my own positions on some of those. I have my positions on some of the things that come up in the United States. We will talk about, in the course of this class, about some of the U.S. positions with regard to international humanitarian law efforts, just where the U.S. stands on some aspects. I do want to mention before I end, though, this is not a law class as such. It's called International Humanitarian Law, and we will be focusing on law. But I don't want anyone to shy away from this because they are not students of law, or that this in particular is not their, a scholarship. It's not so much a scholarly effort as an effort to become aware of what options there are for our promotion of human dignity in all circumstances. And so I hope no one will shy away from the title of the course. So
it's this Saturday. Who's the class for then, and what do you expect them to do with the information that you give them?
Well, the class is for anyone who has an interest in international events, I would say at a minimum, Red Cross volunteers, military families, anyone who has who knows anyone in the military, people in Juneau in particular travel the world widely, and I think of the community of Juneau as being a ready audience for a course that discusses international affairs in this way, because people have either traveled them throughout the world themselves, or they have developed an interest in the goings on in throughout the world. And so it's an excellent opportunity to place it in a context, place what information we already have in a context of how it's then handled in the international legal arena.
Mm-hmm. How's the class structured? It's not just you talking for several hours.
That's true. Thank goodness. We have video presentations that are part of the class, and some exercises for folks to engage each other, talk about what their personal concepts are of human dignity and how we can best meet the needs of human dignity, and there'll be an opportunity for people to share their opinions about how we can best move forward.
And who are the instructors?
I am the instructor. There are two instructors in this course in Alaska. I believe this is the first time this course will be offered in Juneau. There is one other instructor in Anchorage who offered the course a couple of months ago, I believe. But there are very few trained instructors throughout the country. I had to go to Minnesota to receive my training. And so it's not that many opportunities to do this. Now that I have been trained, I hope to be able to offer it every couple of months or so here, if there are participants who are interested here or in other locations throughout the state.
Do you have handouts or suggested reading material?
There's nothing that people would need to read ahead of time, but there is certainly information on the course on the Red Cross website, the American Red Cross website, if people want to learn more about what we'll be covering in the course. And then, of course, there are, a web search to address international humanitarian law will bring up a number of interesting readings if people wish to bring a particular subject to the class or wish to read ahead. That's fine. But we will have a significant package of handouts and some special handouts on special subjects such as child soldiers and that type of subject area to get a better understanding of how international humanitarian law approaches them.
Is there a cost to the workshop?
Oh, it's free. Thank you for mentioning that. I wanted to make sure people know it's completely free of charge. And so I also want to suggest that if someone's listening now who isn't going to be available on Saturday, I would love to hear from them if they have an interest in taking the course at another time. And that way I would try to schedule something that could involve them or their particular group. There's also a course that is designed for high school and for high school students as I get more experienced with this course, I would like to see being offered here in the Juneau school system. But so I'd love to hear from anyone who has an interest in bringing that to the Juneau school system.
Kristen von Bomingen, thank you very much for coming down and talking about your Red Cross course in international humanitarian law going on this Saturday. Where's it going to be held in the hours again, please?
It will be from 10 to 3 at the Mendenhall Valley Public Library Conference Room, and it's free.
Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Let's see. I'll just put out my my phone number and email so that they can contact me if they have an interest in the course and would like to do it at another time. I can be reached at home at 523-2858 and at kbomingen, KBOMENGEN at hotmail.com. And then let me just make sure. I think, yes, I've covered everything.
All right, Kristen, thank you very much for coming down to the station. Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
Oh, no, thank you very much for having me, Jeff.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 16th of April, 2012. It's the birthday of the novelist who wrote, "If you can't annoy somebody, there is little point in writing." Kinsley Amos, born in London, 1922, made it big when he was 32 with his first novel, Lucky Jim, written after a visit to his good friend, the poet Philip Larkin, who worked at University College Leicester. The story of Jim Dixon, a young professor of medieval history, Nice University, disgusted by the pretentious academics all around him. Kingsley Amos wrote more than 20 novels, including That Uncertain Feeling, Take a Girl Like You, Ending Up, The Old Devils, a memoir, essays, and several books about drinking. He said the human race has not devised any way of dissolving barriers, getting to know the other chap fast, breaking the ice, that is one-tenth as handy and efficient as letting you and the other chap cease to be totally sober at about the same rate in agreeable surroundings. It's the birthday of the novelist Anatole France, born Paris, 1844, author of Penguin Island, who said, "The books that everybody admires are those that nobody reads." And it's the birthday of Carol Bly, born in Duluth, Minnesota, 1930, author of The Tomcat's Wife and other stories, and Changing the Bully Who Rules the World. Here's a poem for today by Marge Piercy, entitled The Good Old Days at Home, Sweet Home. On Monday, my mother washed. It was the way of the world. All those lines of sheets flapping in the narrow yards of the neighborhood, the pulleys stretching out second and third floor windows. Down in the dank, steamy basement, washtubs vast and gray, the wringer sliding between the washer and each tub. At least every year she or I caught a hand in it. Tuesday my mother ironed. One iron was the mangle. She sat at it, feeding in towels, sheets, pillowcases. The hand ironing began with my father's underwear. She ironed his shorts. She ironed his socks. She ironed his undershirts. Then came the shirts, a half hour to each, the starch boiling on the stove. I forgot bluing. I forgot the props that held up the line clattering down. I forgot chasing the pigeons that shot on her billowing house dresses. I forgot clothespins in the teeth. Tuesday, my mother ironed my father's underwear. Wednesday, she mended darned socks on a wooden egg, shined shoes. Thursday, she scrubbed floors, put down newspapers to keep them clean. Friday, she vacuumed, dusted, polished, scraped, waxed, pummeled. How did you become a feminist? Interviewers always ask, as if to say, when did this rare virus attack your brain? It could have been Sunday, when she washed the windows. Thursday, when she burned the trash, bought groceries, hauling the heavy bags home. It could have been any day she did again and again what time and dust obliterated at once until stroke broke her open. I think it was Tuesday when she ironed my father's shorts. A poem by Marge Piercy, The Good Old Days at Home, Sweet Home, from her collection Colors Passing Through Us, published by Alfred A. Knopf, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Constant Contact, now offering social campaigns, a new tool designed to help small businesses turn fans into customers. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. And by Reputation.com, offering patented protection for the online reputations of professionals and businesses, now including reputation assessments. Learn more at Reputation.com. Produced by Kathy Roach and written by Betsy Alistair. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
The Juneau World Affairs Council presents Lou Pugliarisi this Wednesday, April 18th, starting at 5 p.m. at the JAC. Lou has served in the National Security Council and is the current president of the Energy Policy Research Foundation in Washington, D.C. His topic is the coming renaissance in North American oil and gas. This event is made possible with support from North Rim Bank, GCI, and the Brady Family Trust. That's this Wednesday at 5 p.m. at the JAC. Admission is free. More details at jwac.org.
This is Bird Note. Artist Chris Jordan brings a deep energy to a huge environmental problem, the accumulation of plastic debris in the world's oceans. He's photographing its effect on the Laysan albatrosses of the North Pacific's Midway Island. Adult albatrosses mistake pieces of plastic for squid and fish and feed them to their chicks, unwittingly killing them. Chris tells us,
the interior of the island is completely covered with magic markers and cigarette lighters and toothbrushes and flip-flops, sandal chunks and random chunks of plastic. And we found a plastic Buddha. And all of that plastic came into the island inside the stomachs of albatross and were fed to their babies who died and was released that way. You know, to be on one of the remotest islands on the planet and to see that much pollution is, it's like the Earth's alarm system going off. But until I stood on Midway, surrounded by hundreds of thousands of baby albatrosses that were in advanced stages of dehydration and starvation with their bodies filled up with plastic, I never felt my love for the planet Earth so deeply. I went through the feelings of horror and shame and fear and grief to get to that love.
Chris has faith in a culture's ability to correct its course.
Art helps us connect with what we feel about things. And that's when we act, is when we feel something deeply.
Find a link to Chris Jordan's photos and film about the albatrosses of Midway on our website, birdnote.org.
Hi, this is Clay Good. I'm hosting the next event in the KRNN Concert Series April 25th at 7 p.m. at the Goldtown Theater. Ed Littlefield and Christian Fabian will perform original music they call Native Jazz, fusing traditional clinket and European melodies with jazz to create a totally unique sound. Both are professional musicians, composers, and performers. This is a show you definitely won't want to miss. April 25th at the Goldtown Theater. Tickets at krnn.org, at the station, or at the door.